Hi everyone, and welcome to this latest edition of the UKIS ITEL podcast. And my guest today is none other than Ian Blackford, former leader, of course, of the SNP in Westminster. I had a long and detailed conversation with Ian about everything ranging from the state of the SNP, the debate about independence, what an independent Scotland's economy might look like, and, crucially, whether he prefers Barbie or Oppenheimer. Hi everyone, and welcome to this latest in our series of Unlocked. A special welcome I've been told to give to a couple of people in the audience who are actually tourists who just popped by on their way past and decided that this was better than seeing the Tower of London or something. Quite right, so the Tower of London is massively overpriced, so you're far better off here, to be quite honest. Our guest tonight is Ian Blackford, known to you all, but Member of Parliament for Ross Skye and, you say it?
Lough Haber.
Thank you very much. Since 2015, there's going to be language issues throughout this.
We can do it in Gaelic if you want as well.
Well, when you say we, I don't think so. He spent 5 years as the SNP's leader in Westminster from 2017. I think, didn't you come against four different prime ministers
in
your time?
Yeah, I did.
So that's pretty impressive. We'll get onto that at some point later on. Thrown out of the Commons twice?
No, I was thrown out once by the previous speaker, and then Lindsay Hoyle made steps to throw me out, but to save his blushes as much as anything else, I actually walked out before he finished.
That was very good of you, I suppose.
So the second time I wasn't actually officially flung out, as they would say back in Scotland.
Left of your own accord.
Left of my own accord.
All right, okay. Well,
having made my point that the Prime Minister was a liar.
I think it's true to say you first stood for election in 97?
I did, right? Yes, in the constituency of Ayr.
Okay, well, that's easy to say. I could have said that.
Yeah,
so that would have been good. And apparently you own a croft on the Isle of Skye where you farm sheep with your wife.
Yeah, indeed. Own, you know, that's a word that strikes at the heart, because there's actually a Gaelic expression. It doesn't really translate very well into English, but it means that you don't own the land, you belong to the land. And it's quite an important expression, because it's about that responsibility you have for husbandry and passing it on to future generations.
Ah, interesting. Okay, and the final thing is, you're a season ticket holder for something called Hibernian. Never heard of them.
Yeah, as my wife would say, my first love, Hibernian Football Club. I wish I was a season ticket holder these days. Living in Skye, it's a bit difficult. But we're going to the start of the new football season. And for every fan of Hibernian, it starts off faith, hope, calamity. I hope this year that the calamity doesn't come along too early.
Well, you're talking to someone whose football season's starting a week earlier than it would have been had we not been relegated, so it's a bit of a sore point. Anyway, we're going to talk about quite a few things. I want to start off with sort of the SNP in Scotland and just go back to a bit of history, because, you know, the background to where you are now and where the SNP are now was the sort of collapse of the Labour vote from around 2009 onwards, we saw that. And what did you put that down to? Why did that happen? Can you explain?
Yes, blood, sweat and tears in many respects. You're right, the SNP has been on a long journey. We were formed way back in 1934. It was the merger of two parties, and we had some modest but fleeting electoral success. We won a by-election in 1945. Dr. Robert McIntyre, my dear old friend that just passed away recently, Winnie Ewing, won the Hamilton by-election in 1967. We had a lot of success in local elections following that. 1970, we won one seat in the general election, 11 in the second election in 74. But it's fair to say that we found it very hard to break the system, break the first-past-the post system. Actually, incidentally, I think a lot of people in Scotland that were voting Labour right through the 90s probably had a residual goodwill towards the SNP, but in many respects they saw voting Labour as the best way to stop the Tories.
Right.
So that was a difficult hurdle to overcome. But I guess having the Scottish Parliament being reconvened in 1999 was an opportunity for the SNP to show what it could do. And that was important in many respects, because the SNP could have been characterised as a movement in some respects up until the re-establishment of the Scottish Parliament. But the SNP had to pivot and become a political party, in essence, and be the opposition, as we were in the first Scottish Parliament. And I think really it was that opportunity to show what we could do, have the ambition that we had for Scotland, that saw us go into administration in 2007. We had one more seat than Labour. It is, perhaps for those that are not so familiar with Scotland, it's a different system, because We have first past the post, we have, as we have in Westminster, we have 73 seats to the Scottish Parliament, first past the post. But we have a top-up system. So there are 56 members elected by the list. That actually, some would argue, was done by the Labour government as a way of stopping the SNP getting a majority. But actually in 2011, we broke the system because for the first time ever at an election to the Scottish Parliament, one party had an overall majority. And in essence, I think what people could say is that people in Scotland at that point were putting their trust in the SNP in the Scottish Parliament election. Then, of course, we had the referendum in 2014. And like, I was disappointed by the result. We came up short, 45%.
Really?
Of course I was.
I mean, you were disappointed, but weren't you chuffed by how well you did?
No.
I mean, given where you started?
No. Goodness gracious, no. You know, I joined the SNP in the 1970s. And I can remember, sadly, very clearly, that the referendum that took place in 1978, the first devolution referendum. And I can remember how I felt that day that we had lost. And actually, the one thing about the independence referendum in 2014, I think it's an important point to discuss, is that feeling around the country, that sense of engagement. And we did a couple of things in that referendum that were perhaps unusual. One, that we gave the votes to EU citizens that were living in Scotland, and we also gave the vote to 16 and 17-year-olds. And one of the things, the thing that probably pleased me most, was to see that engagement from young people. I had a Yes campaign shop in the main street in Portree, in Wentworth Street, and the local high school was around the corner. And to see the young people that would come in on both sides, but wanted to educate themselves in the debate, it was absolutely fascinating. And so that night where we came up short, when we achieved 45% of the vote, I really felt for my children. Mm-hmm. And I really felt for the young people about the hopes and the dreams and the aspirations that we had. In that sense, they had been shattered by that result. And we had to pick ourselves up. And if you'll remember, what happened was that we had the famous vow from the Conservative Party, from Gordon Brown, from the Liberal Democrats, that we were going to get... we were going to get a Home Rule Parliament in the spirit of Keir Hardie. We were going to get a federal UK. Scotland was to lead the United Kingdom. We had the Smith Commission that came out of that promised more powers. And that was the backdrop to the 2015 election, because it was vote for the SNP to deliver these more powers. Well, of course, in reality, much of that never happened. Yeah. And we had the English Votes for English Laws, so we had a situation that Scottish MPs, in some respects, were given a second-class status in the UK Parliament. You know, the message to Scotland was, well, you had your vote. We actually, if you want to put it this way, we held sovereignty in our hands on that day, on the 18th of September 2014, but we chose to give it back to Westminster. And Westminster said, thank you very much, you've had your chance.
If you see me smiling, it is simply because we have two sorts of in-conversation events. We have the ones where you ask questions and the person you're asking questions to says yes or no, and I start panicking that I'm going to run out of questions within about 15 minutes. And then you have the ones like this where actually I'm into one question out of about 30 and I'm thinking, we're not going to have time to fit in about a quarter of these, which makes me feel a lot more comfortable.
I'll try, I look very relaxed.
I'll try and
keep them short. But one of my colleagues rather cruelly said when they were writing about me in The Scotsman after I announced I was standing down, that his speeches can sometimes be as long as his commute. Now, my commute from the north end of the Isle of Skye to Westminster is 8.5 hours, but I'll try not to do that.
Incidentally, on the Slido, you can vote for the questions you want me to put to Ian, so it just makes it easier for me because the most popular ones will rise to the top of my list. So if you look on Slido and see questions that you'd like me to put to him, then just do vote for them. I mean, the flip side of the sort of success story of the SNP has been, you know, as well as we can tell, membership has fallen by about 30,000 or so since 2021, as far as the numbers show. And is this? Do you think this is? There are lots of people putting forward explanations for this. One is the various scandals going on in the party. The other is the fact that in a time of economic crisis, people aren't thinking about things like independence. They're thinking about things like paying the bills. What do you think is going on?
Yeah, but you know, let me put this in context, though. And yeah, you're right. SNP membership has come off the top, and I want it to be a mass membership party. But something really strange happened after that referendum, because I think SNP membership in 2014 was probably around about 20,000 there or so. It went up through 100,000. And I remember the week after the referendum, we had a branch meeting in Skye. All these people turned up, 100 people turned up at a Sky Branch meeting. You know, what on earth are we going to do with them? And they wanted to meet on a weekly basis, believe it or not. So we had created this mass membership, and the SNP membership today, even though it's come off the top, is actually bigger than every other party in Scotland combined. It's quite extraordinary in a way what we've achieved. But I think, I mean, your point about independence, though, because I was struck by a comment that was made by a journalist. I won't name him, perhaps.
Time to get up.
Good grief. Know what happened there, my apologies. That a journalist said to me that if you look back to 2011, the SNP going into government and where we are now, there's probably only been about 1 year where we've had a discussion about independence. Much of the debate has been about process. It's about how Scotland gets that referendum. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's important, but I'd much rather have a debate about what kind of country. Because when you think about the cost of living crisis, and you think about, let's take two things. Let's think about what's happened to people's energy bills. And I get the point that people's energy bills right throughout the United Kingdom have risen. But when I look at this from a Scottish perspective, we've had a massive increase in our green energy output over the course of the last few years. Actually, about 14% of our electricity comes from gas. And we actually produce six times as much gas as we need. Yet the price that we are now paying for electricity is largely based on the wholesale gas market. If it was based on Scottish production, mm-hmm. then we wouldn't be facing anything like the circumstances. So the broken UK energy market punishes us. And I have, you know, I've got my constituents, and they look at the increase in wind production, whether it's onshore or offshore, and say, hang on a minute, we've actually got all this production coming from Scotland. We're actually getting charged the highest prices for grid connectivity, and now we're actually paying a premium to get the stuff back again. That makes no sense. Where is the benefit that we should be getting from that green energy? And that's really important, because I published a report last October called the Skilling Report, and we identified that we uniquely have the opportunity to increase our green energy output fivefold mm-hmm. Between now and 2050, going from 12 gigawatts as it was then to 80. So there's a real opportunity to drive up green energy production, to do it on an affordable basis, and to create a competitive opportunity to have an industrial strategy for an independent Scotland. That's one thing. But then, and of course, remember that we're still exposed to movements in the gas market. We're in the summer, but goodness knows what we could face as we go through the winter. But then, of course, we've got what's happening to mortgages. And I have to say, you've all been let down by governments in London. We are where we are now, with interest rates where they are and the cost of mortgages where they are. But ask yourself a very simple question. Why hasn't the UK done what is the norm in the continent of Europe? What is the norm in the US? And you can have an offering of 25-year mortgages at fixed interest rates for that period. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that anybody should be doing that today. Mm. But the whole point about this crisis that we've now got is done on the basis of policy failure, that the government hasn't directed the institutions that are lending to mortgage owners to be given the opportunity to have long-term fixed-rate mortgages. Now, this could be done, because all you would have to do is issue long-term bonds. Mm-hmm. So if you think about where we are now, and OK, there's slightly better news today on inflation, but the fact that so many people are going to be facing hundreds of pounds a month, 2.5 million people that face renegotiating their mortgage by the end of 2024, and none of this need to have happened.
But there's a flip side, isn't there? I mean, there's an economic price to independence. I mean, it might allow a future Scottish government to do things differently, but, and I don't want to relitigate all the things we said about the Brexit debate, but there is, independence is going to imply borders, it's going to imply impacts on trade, and it's going to impact on the Scottish economy negatively, isn't it?
Is it?
Don't you think?
No.
Why not?
So, let me explain. I mean, I've just published a paper last week, which I would encourage people...
Which you brought with you.
which I'd encourage people to read if they're interested, a roadmap for a Scottish green industrial strategy. And what I've written this in conjunction with Sir Martin Donnelly, who was the mm-hmm. Permanent Secretary at Bayes, and Professor Dominic Holder from the London Business School, and we've tried to focus on what we can do. And actually, if I start by looking at the history, and I use our experience with population. And I've done that going right back to the 1850s, and I've quoted from a book by an academic called Anderson. that's shown that Scotland's relative population in the United Kingdom, every single decade since 1850, has shown relative decline. Now, of course, there can be a myriad of reasons as to why that's happened, but a key element of that is relative economic opportunity. And what I want to do is, as I want to change the dynamic, I want us to show, and some things we can do within the devolution settlement, but what we can do to grow the Scottish economy on a much higher sustainable basis than has been the case in the past. So let me give you two examples. You know, I talked about green energy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you look at the Skilling report, it talks about the potential to create up to 325,000 jobs. So dwarfing what we have today in oil and gas. Now, you need to have an alignment across our education sector between higher education, further education, developing people with the right kind of skills to work in those industries. But also you have to understand that, or we have to understand, that you're doing this in a competitive global environment, that on the basis of everybody is chasing energy security, that we're a smallish part of the offshore wind market around the world. But we need to make sure that we do something that we failed to do with oil and gas and that we failed to do with the early years in green energy, and that is to attract jobs in the supply chain. Now, there was one quite significant announcement a few weeks ago. Sumitomo are building a cable manufacturing facility actually in the Highlands. But one of the things I've suggested in this report is we have to do things differently, and that the First Minister has to accept responsibility for this directly by having an industrial council in his office and making sure you've got an alignment between government and business and actually take the actions that will allow delivery. So we need to speed up the rollout of the 28 gigawatts that will come from Scotland, for example. That's the first thing. The second thing, we're in a fine academic institution here this evening, but we have world-leading universities in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that struck myself, Martin and Dominic when we went around Edinburgh, Glasgow, Strathclyde, I could name them all, is what they're trying to do to develop spin-outs. And what we need to make sure as a country is that we have the resources behind the academic institutions to allow them to achieve the best outcomes in terms of those startups. Now, there's lots of questions around that in terms of finance, in terms of growth finance. But if you think about the US and you think about the disruptors that have emerged over the last generation, not in every case, but in many cases, these disruptors have come out of the academic community. So in that context of focusing on green growth, green energy, how do we make sure that our academic institutions, which are world-leading, have the opportunities to grow startups and spin-outs at scale? So have that real focus on delivering economic growth. And part of the problem we've got in the UK today has actually been an absence of economic growth really since the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike the Labour Party, never mind the Conservatives, we've actually got a plan that will actually allow us to grow the economy. So the issue that the Scottish economy would suffer as a consequence of independence, I want to grow the Scottish economy. We need to start that right now. But if we have the powers that we need to have, let's come back to the academic sector again, last point. How mad is it that we compete to bring in the best students from around the world to our universities, but we don't offer a post-study work visa?
Mm-hmm.
It's nonsensical. And I want us to have a 5-year post-study work visa that allows us to attract talent and keep that talent in Scotland and and be part of our growth story.
I mean, however successful economically an independent Scotland is,
yeah,
you're still, though, dealing with the fact that most estimates, it was an LSE study done 2 or 3 years ago, are saying, and again, it's very similar to the Brexit debate, that through independence, through the impediments on trade with England that would result, you're talking 2-3% impact on GDP from the off. So you're automatically dealing with an economic context.
No, because I'm not sure that the assumptions that they've used are necessarily the right assumptions. But let's take Ireland as an example. If you went back to 1948, something like 90% of Ireland's trade was with the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's now less than 10%, and it's been a one-way street for all of that period. But the thing which is interesting is that Ireland's trade with the United Kingdom has actually increased in value terms in every year since then. But Ireland, as an independent country, had the opportunity to develop its own trade policy and, playing to its strengths, has been able to massively grow its economy to the extent it will have a surplus this year. So it's about taking responsibility and changing the history, changing the record, and showing that we can develop Scotland as a destination for talent to come to, and show that whether it's now or whether it is an independent country, that we can accelerate the delivery of economic growth.
But surely you must accept that at least initially that pain will be felt. I mean, you don't reorient a trade policy, assuming you can do it overnight, and that the impact of significantly decreased trade is going to be a negative economic one. You might be able to deal with that.
One of the reasons, of course, that we want to be independent is because we were taken out of Europe against our will. Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay into the European Union. We've just taken ourselves out of the biggest trading market in the world, the single market and the customs union. So an independent Scotland will be back into Europe and will benefit from the trade opportunities that have been taken away from us. What we need to do is to make sure that we've got a robust plan, that we have a vision, that people can respond to, and they can, we get to the point that it is the settled will of the Scottish people that they want Scotland to be an independent country. We must show the leadership in that and show that we have an effective plan to do that.
Are you not slightly concerned by what's going on in the European Union? There's about to be a debate and a fight about Ukrainian membership. There's Western Balkan membership on the agenda. Enlargement is becoming quite a toxic issue between member states already. Are you not worried that you would just find yourself within, not necessarily at the back of, but within what is becoming rather a lengthy queue, and the gap between independence and accession to the European Union is actually going to be quite long?
No, I don't share that for 1 minute, and I'll tell you why. Because there's a high level of goodwill which is shown towards Scotland. There's ongoing dialogue that we have with our friends and neighbours in the European Union. But remember that as part of the United Kingdom, that we were a member of the European Union, and we still have that broad alignment as things stand today. We were wholly opposed to the UK Single Market Act and the possibilities that there are for divergence from the UK. So we need to make sure that we stay as aligned to Europe as we can do, and that will assist in our reapplication to join. But I think your points, though, about the Balkans are very prescient. I mean, we've just had, sad to say, the anniversary of the massacre in Srebrenica on the 11th of July. And there are things which are going on in the Balkans which should absolutely worry all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have got from the European Union as a desire to be a player for good, to make sure that we can continue with that peace in that part of the world. And I think offering that hope of membership of the European Union to those in that region is, of course, an important factor.
OK, I'm not going to keep banging on about this, but one final thing. Do you accept that if and when an independent Scotland accedes to the European Union, there is a hard EU border, external EU border between Scotland and England, which will have an enormous impact on trade across that border?
There is, of course, going to have to be a process of negotiation, and we've lived through the prolonged difficulties in the situation with Northern Ireland. But in the end, with the Windsor Agreement, there is a way through that. And there's a way through that recognises, for example, that you still get free movement of people between Ireland and the UK. I think sometimes our unionist opponents will want to play up what they see as the problems of that. And of course, there are challenges that have to be overcome. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But I think with goodwill on both sides, we can find a way through that. Let's remember that an independent Scotland will see those in the rest of the UK as our dearest friends, our nearest neighbours, and certainly people that we would want to cooperate and work with. One of the things that will happen out of this is it will strengthen the operation of the British Irish Council. So let's be a force for good rather than anything else. And let's make sure that we have, just as we have with the relationship between the UK and Ireland as sovereign independent states, that will happen between the rest of the United Kingdom and Scotland as well.
Okay. I'm going to get back on. I went off on a complete tangent there. I'm sorry. I've completely left my questions behind. So let me get back to them. Just in terms of politics within Scotland again, Labour now, I think, just 3 points behind the SNP in the polling. Are you concerned that they're going to be a real challenge at the next general election, and that in the current context, actually, they might do rather well at the next general election in Scotland?
I think you've always got to take seriously the threat that there can be from any other party. And you're right, there's been a pickup in the Labour poll ratings over the recent past. I think there is a desire that the electorate have for change. And we need to make sure that we are emphasising what is the offer of the SNP. But I think this has actually been an important week, because there is that question that if people in Scotland might have been tempted to vote for the Labour Party as an alternative, what is the offer? And what we've seen in Scotland over the course of the last few days, even from Labour parliamentarians in the Scottish Parliament, is outrage that Keir Starmer has announced that he's going to keep the two-child limit, that he's not going to reverse what the Tories have done. And that's an extraordinary move, because in effect what you're doing is you're condemning young people, families, to remain in poverty. We came into politics to make a difference to people's lives, and to see a Labour Party that are going to continue with the policies of the Tory party that have done so much damage with the cuts that we've seen to Social Security. I think a lot of people in Scotland are going to look at that and ask that question: what is the point in voting for Labour?
I don't know if you saw the piece this morning by Kenny Farquharson about precisely this, about the opportunity that what Starmer said about the two-child policy provided for the SNP. One of the interesting things he said was that many SNP voters are progressives first and nationalists second. Is that a characterisation that you'd agree with?
I've got a lot of time for Kenny, but I think in some respects he's always had this blind spot when it comes to independence. Look, the SNP, when you look at the modern SNP, look at the SNP that's been in government in Scotland now since 2007. We're a progressive left-to-centre political party. It's about the values that come with that. I've always expressed the view that it's not where you're from, it's where you're going. And it's about the country that you want to be. And, you know, in that economic philosophy that I've spelled out, that we need to attract talent. And I'm less concerned about this issue of nationalism or identity than I am about making sure that Scotland can be a successful small country. And I think that's the point I would say with respect to Kenny, that he doesn't understand. You know, there's an important point in all of this. I would say that perhaps the leading economist looking at small countries around the world is David Skilling, who was the author of my Skilling report last year. And it's interesting when you look at his work and when you look at other academic work, that you would draw the conclusion that the countries that perform best in the main are small countries. So you're talking about countries with a population of 10 million, tend to have the best outcomes when it comes to GDP growth, tend actually to have the best outcomes when it comes to health and education. And one of the conclusions that not only has he drawn, that others have drawn, is that there are no economies of scale for large countries. So the opportunities to develop social policy, to deliver the opportunities for economic growth, are actually best achieved as a small country. And that's one of the advantages of being a small country in the European Union. And I'm not sure that Kenny fully understands and appreciates those arguments.
Okay. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about confidence and supply and Keir Starmer's refusal to countenance any sort of agreement with the SNP. But realistically, if Keir Starmer forms a new government, he doesn't need an agreement with the SNP, because you're not going to vote a Labour government down and risk another Conservative government, are you? I mean, he's got your support locked, hasn't he?
Well, I'm not going to be there, so that will be up to up to others that return.
You said that with a big grin.
Well, yeah, but yeah. Let me say this though, that I hope that above all else that Keir Starmer is a Democrat. Now let's come back to this point about 2014, because one of the things in 2014 contained in the Smith Commission is that there was a recognition by all parties of Scotland's right to choose if it wishes to become an independent country. Now, we're told that this is a union of equals. We're told it's a union of consent. So let's just explore that for a second in that context. Because in the 2021 Scottish parliamentary election, both the SNP and the Greens had a manifesto commitment of delivering a referendum on Scottish independence if we won. Now, as everybody knows, there's an independence majority in that parliament. Now, I assume everybody in this room, all fine-minded people, are all Democrats. What right has any Prime Minister got to turn round to the Scottish Parliament when that parliament has been elected by the votes of Scottish people on the basis of a manifesto commitment of delivering an independence referendum and Westminster says no? And we're going to go into the next election where, in some way, shape or form, the constitutional question is going to be put there. Let me, you know, I'd ask the question to the current Prime Minister, I'd ask the question to Keir Starmer. What do the Scottish people have to do to leave this union? If it's not done on the basis of votes either to Holyrood or Westminster, what is the mechanism? And I would say to whoever is Prime Minister, to ignore the democratic wishes, to ignore the votes of those elect parliamentarians either to Holyrood or Westminster, is a very dangerous place to be.
But isn't repeatedly holding referenda on the same issue dangerous as well?
Who's holding a referendum on the same issue? The whole point, Alan, when circumstances change, that people have a right to change their minds. And one of the key elements of the referendum in 2014 is that the the Unionist Party has said if Scotland wants to stay in the European Union, then Scotland has to stay in the United Kingdom. Well, how did that work? Because within 2 years, a referendum has taken place on the UK's membership of the European Union. Scotland voted 62% to remain. In fact, all the polling that's taken place since then has shown that that desire to have remained in the European Union is indeed stronger. So that promise that was given to the people of Scotland, and we could talk about the promise of a union of equals as well that was broken. So in the context of that, of course, it's quite right that people say that the circumstances have changed. And on the basis of those changed circumstances, that it's right that we have that say. But let me give you another example. In the history of Northern Ireland is one which, of course, is deeply troubled, and we can all share in the success of the Good Friday Agreement. Thank goodness we've had relative peace in the island of Ireland over the course of the last 25 years. But contained within that Good Friday Agreement is the possibility of a border poll every 7 years. Mm. So the concept of a border poll in Northern Ireland is accepted. Why is it that Westminster can continually turn round to the people of Scotland? Because it's not turning round to the SNP, it's turning round to the voters in Scotland and saying, we're not respecting your right to have a say in your future, because that's what it is.
Okay, I want to stick with the potential of a Labour government for the moment. What did you make of the Brown Review and what it said about Scotland?
Well, I mean, Gordon Brown was the architect of the vow. And I've got a lot of respect for the intellect and the capabilities of Gordon, but my message to Gordon is we've heard it all before. And this desire for a federal United Kingdom, well, look, yeah, of course, and if people in the rest of the UK want to go down that road, that should be their choice. But let's again come back to that promise of the vow. And let's also come back to the issue of respect to the Scottish Parliament. There's a technical issue in the legislation that established the Scottish Parliament a way back, or the Scotland Act as it went through in 1998, and that was the so-called Sewell Convention. Mm-hmm. And the Sewell Convention meant that Westminster could not legislate on devolved matters without the consent of the Scottish Parliament. That's been the established principle since devolution. But of course, what happened with Brexit was that Westminster turned round and said, well, times are not normal. Mm. So we're not going to have to get the consent of the Scottish Parliament or the Welsh Parliament or the Northern Ireland Executive if they're legislating on devolved matters. And there have been so many examples of that over the course of the last few years. So it's an intolerable situation when you see that what has happened is that powers have been taken back from the Scottish Parliament. There's been an attack on our Scottish Parliament, and there's nothing we can do about it. And there's nothing in these powers that Gordon Brown has talked about will change that position.
Not even when he talks about enshrining the current settlement.
Yeah, but what I've explained is that Westminster can then turn round and say that we don't agree to that anymore. And what we actually see is a parliament in Edinburgh, which is considered to be one of subsidiarity to the parliament in Westminster.
Do you think politically, I think we've lost our tourists, by the way. I'm absolutely gutted. I think they've left. But I don't know if that's a comment on you or me, but anyway. Secretly, it's a lot easier for you having a Tory government in London, isn't it, as the SNP?
No, absolutely not. And a lot of people would say to me over the last few years, why was I so determined to get rid of Boris Johnson? Well, there are many reasons why I think many people would agree that it was right to get rid of Boris Johnson. I never want a Tory government. But you see, this is the difference between Labour in Scotland and ourselves, because Labour in Scotland are saying, vote for us at the next election and we'll get rid of the Tories. For me, it's very simple. I'm saying if Scotland becomes an independent government, we'll get rid of Tory governments forever. That's the difference between us and the Labour Party. And I certainly don't want the kind of damage, the economic damage that's been delivered. You know, we talked about the fact that there's been no economic growth since the financial crisis. And actually, there's been a real mismatch between monetary policy and fiscal policy. Yeah. The fact that the current generation are the first generation to be poorer than their parents. The challenge that young people face, having perhaps bought their homes over the course of the last few years, it's quite scandalous what has taken place. Look at what has happened with quantitative easing. We've driven up asset prices. Those of our generation have done relatively well at the cost of those that have come behind us. It's unacceptable, and that's the kind of damage that the Tory government has done to us over the course of the last few years.
But are you not concerned that it's easier to get support in Scotland for the SNP if you can point to Tories in Westminster.
No.
I mean, you're not concerned that actually that, particularly a Labour government that's committed to some things along the lines of the Brown.
Let's wait and see, because we've had a number of U-turns from Keir Starmer over the last few weeks. So let's see what kind of government we get from Labour. But the fundamental point I would make is it's our responsibility to have that vision as to what kind of country Scotland can be. So it's not about who's in power in Westminster, because at the end of the day, I want to change the outcomes for people's lives. I want to drive people out of poverty. I want to deliver sustainable economic growth. I want to drive the investment into our economy. I want to drive up productivity. But the reason I want to do that is because I want us to increase the tax base to have the resources that allow us to invest in our public services and once and for all, deal with the social problems that we have. And then there was a report written, it was a UK report, and there was a Scottish report written back in the 1970s called Born to Fail. A lot of the issues that were covered in that analysis are still with us today, and we need to fix it. And I want to come back to what I said about small countries and that cohesion that you get in small countries, where people actually recognise there is a point in paying fair tax because they can see what they actually get in terms of outcomes and living in a fairer, more equal society.
I want to talk a little bit about your experience in Westminster. I mean, firstly, everyone knows you from the clips of you at PMQs. Mm. Do you enjoy doing those questions?
Seem
to.
Yes, I did. Of course I did. I regretted the fact, I suppose, in a way, that so much of the week went into preparation for that. We would have a meeting, myself and my senior staff, at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, and we'd begin the process of planning. We would meet in the Wednesday morning. So much of the working week went into prepare for Prime Minister's questions. And I suppose, being the leader of the third party, the leader of the opposition gets six questions. A lot of people's interest perhaps starts to wane at that point. That's for many people what they see as the high point of PMQs. So I would come further down the batting order. And I suppose in
order
to...
So you do like cricket?
Well, I've used it as a euphemism in this particular case. But you need to make sure that you're in the mix. Hmm. You need to be relevant. So as the leader of the third party, perhaps you have to be a bit edgy in terms of how you would do it, so make sure you get picked up by the news. I do regret that over the course of that whole period, there were really three things that dominated. So it was Brexit, it was COVID, it was Boris. And at the beginning of every week, I'd think, okay, we need to do something different. There's lots of other issues I would like to cover. But of course, you realise that if you covered any other issues, then the media simply weren't going to pick you up. In a kind of idealistic world, when I started, I had this view that one week I'd maybe do something about Scotland, the second week about the UK, and the third week about international affairs. Because I think it is important that you use your time to, you know, you talked about the Balkans, to talk about Srebrenica and things like that, to talk about the genocide in these places. And I always did that, by the way. I did that every year at the anniversary. But I think it's important that you can be as expansive as you can be, but at the same time seeking to be relevant.
And do you think PMQs is sort of an important part of our democratic process? Do you think it's worth it in a way?
I mean, no. No is a simple answer. It's political theatre at its very worst. It's theatre for ugly people, if I may put it that way.
Well, you spent a lot of time up against Boris Johnson. Just reflecting back on his time as Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, what do you think his legacy is? It's a little softball one for you.
there are words I probably can't say in polite company, but...
You're fine here.
So, I mean, I can remember a Prime Minister question before he became Tory Prime Minister when Theresa May was still there. And actually, that is a moment I almost got thrown out of the Commons by the previous Speaker, because I basically called Boris Johnson a racist. I gave the Speaker examples of his language and his behaviour and the things he said and done. But my question to Tory party MPs and Tory party members, what on earth were you thinking? Putting a man like that into political office, a man that I have to say was just so unsuited to be Prime Minister, a complete liar and charlatan. And he just simply should never have been there. And I think the man has done so much damage to these islands, and actually so much damage to our political discourse, because... You know, the way that he behaved, and if you think back to the time of Brexit, and those of us that had a different opinion, we were collaborators. The language that was used, And it was disgraceful to see the abuse that MPs would get, women MPs in particular, because the toxicity of that place just increased beyond belief. And I regret that we moved on from Theresa May to Boris. And actually, one of the other factors was that Theresa May was a very decent person, and she understood the importance of the office that she held and disagreed with her politics and so much as she went about her business. But she understood the role of Prime Minister, and she understood the role of the opposition parties. So myself and the leader of the Labour Party, when it came to matters of national security, things like Salisbury, for example, when the strikes took place in Syria, we would be called in and we'd meet with the National Security Advisor on Privy Council terms, and we'd have the opportunity to ask questions so we could prepare ourselves rightly to then respond to the Prime Minister and the House of Commons. And I think it was right to take Salisbury as an example, that I stood up and I stood shoulder to shoulder with the Prime Minister against what was a heinous attack on the streets of the United Kingdom by agents of the Russian state to poison those that were living in our territory. It was completely unacceptable. But Boris Johnson never understood that. And I remember when it came to Afghanistan, that we hadn't had that same briefing. We were actually offered late in the day a meeting for all opposition parties where we'd get the opportunity to ask one question each of the National Security Advisor. You cannot have that as a way that politics works in this country. And I want to applaud, actually, Ben Wallace, because Ben has made sure that myself, Keir Starmer, Ed Davey, on a bi-weekly basis, in many cases, were getting briefings as to what was going on in Ukraine.
Okay.
And again, it was so important that we all stood together against a war criminal, Putin. But you can only do that effectively if you're given the information that you need to have. And Boris simply saw all of us as the enemy, that this information wasn't to be shared with us. It was a disgrace.
I've got to ask you, what did you make of Jeremy Corbyn's reaction to Salisbury?
I'm sad to say that Jeremy Corbyn miscalled that really badly. Mm. And I think he let himself down and let his party down by not standing shoulder to shoulder with the rest of us at that moment. Well, that was absolutely the right thing to do.
Okay. Given what you said about Boris Johnson and his tenure, do you regret backing an election at the tail end of 2019 and voting in favour of it? Was there not a way of preventing Boris Johnson as Prime Minister via delaying that election?
No, because I'll tell you why. Because at that moment, the second reading of the bill that was taking us out of the European Union had passed because a number of Labour MPs had gone into the lobbies with the Tories. And we then knew that as things stood, that there was a majority for Boris's deal, effectively, whatever it was, this so-called oven-ready deal, that there was a majority in the House of Commons for that to take place. So the only mechanism that we had at that point was an election. Now, I knew that we were in a good place in Scotland. We didn't know what was going to happen in the rest of the United Kingdom. I regret the result that took place. But in Scotland, of course, we went from 35 to 48 MPs.
Hmm.
So we did our job. We actually halved the Tory representation from Scotland. But of course, Jeremy Corbyn was unsuited to deliver the same kind of result elsewhere in the United Kingdom.
And during the Brexit period, did you work very, very closely with other parties?
Yes.
And in a way that was sort of completely novel and a lot?
Yes, it was. So we had regular meetings with the Liberal Democrats, with the Greens, with Plaid Cymru.
Mm.
Over time, when you had Change UK and various others that came together, and then that group was expanded. But again, I do want to give credit to Vince Cable, because we all worked very well together, because there was a common interest that we had. And at a certain point, those meetings were extended to the Labour Party as well, and at least on a working level, I had a very good relationship with Jeremy Corbyn. And it went beyond that, because of course there were a number of Tory rebels that we worked with at that point as well.
You touched briefly on the tone of debate and the abuse that some MPs face. I mean, over the last couple of years, we've seen a large number of allegations against MPs for bullying and harassment. Do you have confidence in parliamentary procedures for dealing with those sorts of allegations?
I think there was a genuine attempt when Theresa May was Prime Minister to deal with the problem.
Mm.
And we had a meeting of all party leaders that set up the process that led to the ICGS that was actually led by the then leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, with her opposite numbers. So there was a real desire to make sure that we could deal with it. I think there's been some important improvements, but the system's not perfect. And I think on the basis of the experience, and by the way, one of the aspects of it is it takes far too long. And I think it's right that Parliament revisits this on the basis that we use best practice and that we make sure in particular that staff and others are fully protected to the highest extent. So we've come some way, but I think it's right that we review that based on experience of the last few years.
Now, you're standing down, as you said, but you've also got a number of very young colleagues like Mari Black who've made the decision to... Does that make you worry about politics and about the profession itself?
You know, we've touched on social media and the atmosphere, and I do wonder why young people in particular might want to come into politics because of the environment, and I think all of us have a responsibility to tackle that. What happens in social media these days is an absolute disgrace. The abuse that people get, whether that's politicians, whether it's journalists. And I think we have to do better, frankly. And it's, you know, we talked about women MPs, the fact that two MPs have lost their lives over the course of the last few years as well. I suspect there's not an MP over the last few years that's not been threatened.
Mm.
I never make an issue of it for myself, as it's certainly not about me, but there are two people that have been charged with threatening me, although admittedly one was not just threatening me, but others, and got a custodial sentence, one got a suspended sentence. These things happen. And a lot of what happens in social media, quite simply, is not acceptable.
Mm.
It's not acceptable. And we have to call it out. And we need the help of our friends in the media as well. All of us have a shared responsibility in tackling this. We need to be able to raise the quality of debate. You know, can I just say, and I'm not having a pop at anybody, I'm not having a pop at any in the media that are perhaps are here or watching online, but if I take this document, I hope it's an important document, and I'd welcome, you know, a critical analysis of what's in it. And we actually had some decent media coverage last Friday when we launched this, but not to the extent you might think. Because it's far easier to talk about the personalities, the conflict, than it is perhaps sometimes to talk about the issues that are actually really important that will make a difference to people's lives. So I think we've got to do better.
Mm.
But that's not an attack on any individual or any journal or any broadcast organisation. But we need to be able to raise the quality of debate.
Yeah. Though it's difficult for media outlets, isn't it? Because it's a competitive market and they need to...
Yeah, no, of course it is. Indeed it is.
More and more competitive. So just a couple of questions on your role as a sort of leader of the party in Westminster. Firstly, were you ever frustrated by what was happening in Edinburgh? Were there ever times when you said, actually, that doesn't work for us down here, that line that you're taking? Were there...
No. No, and I'll tell you why.
Was that because you all agree? Was that because you have great coordination mechanisms or...?
Well, you know, I've been elected as an MP in 2015 and I was the SNP pension spokesperson. There was no grand plan of becoming SNP leader. I wasn't ambitious to become SNP leader. It kind of happened after the 2017 election. But the weekend before it did, I had a conversation with the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. And I said to her that I would support the Scottish Government. If I had issues with things I disagree with, then we would discuss it, but we would discuss these things privately. But my job was to reflect what the Scottish Government was doing, to give it amplification, and to be a confidant and a supporter of the First Minister. I make no apology for that. We are good friends. So we were able to discuss things, and I believe I was a confidant of hers as she was a confidant of mine. We were a great support to each other. So I think there are ways that you can do these things, but I think a message for all of us, whether it's the SNP or any other political party, that parties have to demonstrate that they're worthy of the trust of the public. And parties that are not united are going to find it much more difficult to do that.
The other thing that you've touched on is, I think you've, is it true that you've got the longest commute to Westminster of any MP? You must be pretty close to having the longest commute. I mean, how long is, I remember bumping you at Glasgow Airport and you told me how many hours you'd already been on the road to get there.
Ah, yeah, that's, yeah, there are times that can be a particular challenge. So I live in the north end of the Isle of Skye, which is the most beautiful place. If those haven't been there, please come and visit us.
That's not the one that's joining Norway, is it?
But my closest airport is Inverness. It's 145 miles. Not only is it 145 miles, but I think about 35 miles of that is on a single track road. So I can't do it in less than in 3.5 hours. And of course, there are not that many flights from Inverness as well. And that was a particular issue in the winter, because the only flight I could get on a Monday morning from Inverness was 6:50 in the morning.
Right.
So you would have to leave Skye at 2:30. Not great in the winter. So my only other alternative was to drive to Glasgow. So that's a 6-hour drive. So you're really then talking about 10, 11 hours just to get to your place of work. So tomorrow morning, as an example, I mean, I'll get the 7:55 flight tomorrow morning from Heathrow, so you're up at 4:30, and I'll get back to Skye in the middle of the afternoon. So that's almost your whole day. Is gone. So there's a huge amount of downtime. Look, I'm not complaining, because when you stand for Parliament, you put yourself forward for that, and you have to accept that that's what comes with it. But it's not just the fact that the commute's so long. My constituency is the biggest by a long way in all of these islands. It's 12,000 square kilometres. It's the same size as Northern Ireland, which has 18 constituencies. I've got two constituency offices, one in Fort William, one in Dingwall. I live in the constituency, but my two constituency offices are 130 miles from where I live. And I do surgeries in 32 places over the course of the year. So it's a massive, massive constituency.
But more seriously, does that, not the size of the constituency, which is a different issue, but does that work? Because you're effectively losing 2 days a week.
Yeah.
Travelling.
Yeah.
I mean, is that...
It's mad.
How does that work? I mean, how do you do a constituency job and be leader of the party? I mean, someone's losing out of that, aren't they?
Yeah, your family's losing out, because in essence, you don't really get any downtime. So,
yeah.
So what I used to do when I flew back to Inverness, invariably I would go somewhere in the constituency, because once I get back home, the idea of going from the north end of Skye back to Fort William or Dingwall for a constituency event, well, you know, again, that's another 7-hour round trip. So you have to try and manage your diary. And what gives is your family time. You know, I talked about getting the 6:50 in the morning. Actually, when I was Westminster leader, invariably I would leave on a Sunday. So I'm getting back on Friday night and I'd be leaving on Sunday. But to get the flight from Inverness on Sunday afternoon, that meant leaving Sunday lunchtime. So you're really, you're giving up an awful lot. But I said, for goodness sake, I'm not complaining. You signed up for it and you take that. But it does mean that your family has to make a sacrifice and all of that.
Am I right in saying that you've not ruled out standing for election to Holyrood?
I'm still a young man. No.
Look, is that... aren't we all?
Yeah, indeed. Look, I mean, I've talked a couple of times about this report. I'm really, if I'm focused on anything, it's about making sure that the Scottish Government can deliver. So I suppose there is a question for me, how can I best help? I was given the role of Nicola Sturgeon's business ambassador when I stood down as Westminster leader. Hamza has reappointed me to that post. I will help. We'll wait to see how the government responds to this. The government has to give its response to the paper. But I think in one way or the other, I'll assist the government in the delivery of its economic programme. So does that mean I'm elected? Does it mean I'm not elected? I'm open-minded about these things. There's lots of things I can do.
You don't sound like someone who's done with politics.
You know, if I'm really honest, I mean, I was lucky. I had a career in the city. And I left the city in 2003 when I was in my early 40s. I had effectively retired. I set up my own consultancy business and then wound that down just before doing this. I don't think I'm the kind of person that's suited to retirement, if I may put it that way. I think there's still a bit of life in the old dog yet.
Where do you stand on this idea that's been doing the rounds in the SNP about a de facto referendum?
You know, I want to take you back to the issue that I touched on earlier, because we're back about process.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, if Scotland's to become an independent country, what we need to do is demonstrate that that is the, the settled will of the Scottish people. And let's have that discussion about what kind of country. I want to drive up support. I want to make sure that Scotland becomes independent as quickly as possible. The SNP conference later on this year will have a discussion about the mechanisms, the roadmap for independence. But let's win the hearts and minds. That's more important, I would suggest, than the question of a de facto referendum here and now.
Okay, on a slightly techier issue, I mean, the Scottish Government made a loud commitment to maintaining alignment with EU rules and regulations, but actually has done very little of that. Has that disappointed you? Is that a decision that's being made?
I'm not sure why you make that comment. I think the Scottish Government is determined as far as possible to make sure that that alignment remains, but it's difficult when you've got things like the UK Single Market Act. Mm-hmm. That is a constraint on our ability to do that. And we certainly didn't want the bonfire that seems now to have the... It seems to have been dialed down in terms of the striking out of EU laws in our legislative competence.
I mean, when it comes to the Internal Market Act, do you not have some sympathy with the central principle that the UK needs to have a single market without border, without barriers between the different nations?
Nobody's arguing that it should be barriers, but I think you've got to respect the differences that exist. I mean, let me give you a real example. I mean, we have, I'm a crofter, so I'll declare an interest, but we're really talking about subsistence farming. It's something which is unique to Scotland. Now, you could argue, in the context of the UK Single Market Act, that it's not fair to do that. Try that with the crofters and see where you get to. I suspect not very far. But in effect, that would be against the ethos and the principle of the UK Single Market Act. That makes no sense. So you have to, I think you have to accept the cultural and the logistical differences that mm-hmm. exist in different parts of the United Kingdom.
And just finally, a couple of things. I mean, firstly, you've just been appointed to the Committee on Standards in Public Life.
Finally.
I know. We're getting there. Yes. We always try to finish on time because I get hungry. You're appointed to the Committee on Standards in Public Life. If you could make one recommendation and you knew it would be adopted to improve the standard of public life, what would it be?
Well, I think the Nolan principles are really important. We need to make sure that they can be enacted. And I mean, I think when the committee actually does a good body of work... But I think we need to improve integrity, honesty. Ministers been held to account, not just ministers, but right across our public life. So I think that's something I need to reflect on as I go into the committee. But I'm not going to turn around to the committee and say, this is what we should be doing. I think I need to observe what they'll be doing and try and play a positive and a constructive role within its work. Okay.
And you spoke quite a lot earlier about universities. What did you make of the rhetoric from the government this week on so-called Mickey Mouse or low return degrees?
I mean, it's just insulting, isn't it? It really is. I mean, again, what are we doing? I mean, I do think we have to have more of an alignment between higher and further education, mm-hmm. but that's a slightly different story because, again, that's about making sure right through society that we've got the right skills, the appropriate skills for the challenges that we have in delivering a high-skilled economy. But to try and belittle people that are going to university and achieving degrees, simply it's insulting.
But there is a problem with the funding model for universities, isn't there? I mean, I know Scots do it differently, but...
Yeah, we do, because we don't have tuition fees in Scotland, I'm glad to say. So, but of course, that does bring its challenges. And that comes back to the point of the work that we're doing about making sure that these institutions can compete globally, as many of them do very successfully. So I think the whole model of funding of universities has changed mm-hmm. dramatically. There's been a desire, a need to do that. But I think the success of the spin-out model, of universities being able to participate in the IP of the spin-outs in particular, and we need to have an effective model for allow that to work. But I'm actually quite optimistic and enthusiastic about making sure that we've got a funding model for universities that can be successful, but making sure, as part of that, that access from students from our own community, that these universities remain open to local talent.
And you're not concerned that universities in England have an unfair advantage because of the fees they can charge and the income they're getting?
We need to make sure that Scottish universities can be fully competitive.
But someone's going to have to pay for that.
Yeah, I mean, if I take Heriot Watt University, because it's just a figure I've got off the top of my head, 12% of the funding for Heriot Watt University comes from the Funding Council. The rest comes from other sources. And I think, in a sense, that shows you the success of Heriot Watt as an institution. They're bringing in finance from a range of different sources.
Okay. Before we finish, and you'll have time to have a drink and chat to some members of the audience, you have to do our all new, all shiny, new elite quiz.
Do we really?
Yeah. One-word answers to all of these, all right?
Which is not easy for any politician, at least of all me. I saw Neil Kinnock's...
you're familiar with this,
I'm familiar with the concept, yeah.
Yeah, Neil doesn't do one-word answers, so let's see how we get on with this. So, BBC or Netflix?
Oh, good grief. I'm going to say BBC, because it's an institution which is under attack. It's going to do better in many respects, but I'm all behind public sector broadcasting.
All right, Guardian or GB News?
Oh, Guardian.
USA or EU?
I want us to be in the EU, but there are aspects of the US.
That's several words. Respect.
I know. But these are not yes or no answers.
This is Prince Harry or Piers Morgan?
Oh, Prince Harry.
Greggs or Pret?
We don't have either in the Isle of Skye.
But were you to have them
or
both?
Pret.
All right.
Yeah.
Really? Shame on you. God. Yeah. All right. Hotel or Airbnb?
Hotel. We don't do... Hotel.
Tofu or sausages?
Sausages.
Levelling up or cutting taxes?
Levelling up.
Bike or car? All right, you've said how big your constituency is. Bike doesn't sound like it's going to work.
No, it can be a joy to travel through Skye in a bike, but it has to be a car. Yeah.
All right, EV or SUV?
For the same reason, because I would love to have an electric car, but unfortunately, given where I live for now, it has to be SUV.
Beer or wine?
On a hot night like this, beer.
All right, maths or English?
English.
Sciences or humanities?
With regret, humanities.
Okay, good for you. Football or rugby?
Football.
Twitter or TikTok?
Twitter.
Cash or contactless?
These days, contactless. COVID changed everything.
All right, LTNs, yes or no?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this elsewhere, so I know the answer.
Yeah, careful with this one.
It has to be yes.
All right, Imperial or metric?
I'm of a certain age. You know, when I go to the butchers, I still ask for a thing in pounds.
All right, and the decider, Barbie or Oppenheimer?
What? Jeez.
If you had a choice, you could see one of them, which would you see? Yeah, this is going to reflect on you, so think about it. I'm off to see Barbie on Saturday. I'm very excited.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, I would love to have gone with you. From that basis, I'll say Barbie.
Well, you should tell me. Is that a pass on the final one?
That's a pass on the final one.
Ian, thank you ever so much. That was fantastic. Cheers.
Thank you.